From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. On Mondays this month, we're running a special series called The 50-Year Fight, Solutions for Closing the Achievement Gap. The idea is that after 50 years, gaps persist in education. But in that half century, there have also been efforts that worked, even if in just one school or one classroom. Well, last week, we spoke with Prudence Carter. She's dean of the Graduate School of Education at the University of California, Berkeley. And she talked about the macro impact of systemic anti-poverty programs and providing struggling schools with more resources and how that has helped close achievement gaps in certain places. But she also said you have to take a micro approach as well.
The kind of curriculum, is it a high-quality, rich, engaging curriculum that is going to motivate and compel students?
Motivate and compel. On the face of it, it seems rather obvious. How can children learn and excel meaningfully if they're not compelled by the curriculum? But on the flip side, how can a community know its children are learning if what they're learning is rather difficult to test? So we're going to take a look at a few approaches. They're called deep learning, experiential learning. You may have heard of project-based learning. And we're going to ask this hour on Point, can deep learning and those approaches close achievement gaps? And we want to hear from you. Parents, have you seen these types of learning or curricula at work in your school? I mean, how do you feel when teachers start reinventing the classroom experience? Has it made school and education richer for your child? Or do you worry that students might be missing on key information and critical skills that they need to take those high-stakes tests or those end-of-year exams or college admissions exams? Do you worry that they are missing the skills they need to succeed beyond high school? And teachers, what are some of the benefits and some of the challenges of doing more experiential learning in class? Join us anytime at On Point Radio or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. I should say our website is onpointradio.org. Well, joining us first today from the studios of NPR West in Culver City, California, is Pedro Noguera. He is the founder of the Center for the Transformation of Schools at the University of California, Los Angeles. He's a distinguished professor in education at the UCLA Graduate School of Education, and he's a sociologist focused on social and economic conditions in schools. Pedro Noguera, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Meghna.
It's great to have you. So let's start off with some of the ABCs of deep learning. And that's the phrase I'll sort of use throughout the hour here. What is deep learning and what does it look like inside of a classroom?
So deep learning really is simply about tapping into the higher order thinking skills of a child, the ability to process information, to think critically, to analyze information, to apply concepts in other settings. It goes well beyond memorization. And when you think about it, all children, regardless of their backgrounds, are naturally curious. They come to the world asking questions about why the world works the way it does, and why is the most common question you ever hear from a three-year-old. When you feed that curiosity, kids become independently motivated learners, and deeper learning is what channels that. It channels curiosity, and curiosity leads to kids who are intrinsically motivated. And that's what we should be after in school. Kids who are not just interested in taking a test or getting good grades, but who are willing to continue learning even after the test is over.
But isn't that what ostensibly is happening every day in most, if not all, American schools? I mean, I think teachers would say their fundamental goal is to try to nurture that curiosity about the world and the love of learning.
No. We have clear evidence that what we've been doing in many schools, and not just for disadvantaged kids, but for privileged kids as well, is having the opposite effect. Across the country, we're seeing fewer kids reading books. We're seeing math scores decline and a lot of fear of math out there. We're seeing kids who, even the kids who do well, not inspired. How often do kids come home and say, wow, what a day. I learned so much. Can't wait to continue what we started. Unfortunately, that doesn't happen nearly enough. So I would say that in our focus on achievement, what we've forgotten is that the path to achievement is through deeper engagement in learning. When we get kids deeply involved in learning and they take ownership and investment in it, then they're more likely to achieve.
Okay, so talk to me more about that, because that hits right at the heart of this major issue we're talking about, that we have as a nation been talking about and struggling with this question of achievement between kids across socioeconomic divides, in different racial groups. And if you're saying that our very focus on that has actually held kids back, I mean, what are you talking about? What do you mean?
Well, you know, it's we've gotten locked into some, I think, false choices, whether or not we test or not test. You have to assess students to see whether or not they're learning. The question is, how do you use the test, and how whether or not the test is being used to inform teaching and learning? And I would say right now we use testing to rank kids, not to figure out what do kids need more of, and how do we adjust our teaching to respond to the needs of our kids. The analogy I would make is if you wanted to lose weight, you wouldn't focus on getting the best scale possible. You would focus on your diet and your exercise. Well, the equivalent in school is to get better results from kids, we've got to focus. How do we get them more deeply engaged? How do we get kids to read on their own? How do we get kids to be good problem solvers? Those are the kinds of skills, what we call deeper learning, that result in higher achievement.
Okay, so I'm a learn by example kind of person myself. So let's talk about a couple of examples of what this might look like in successful classrooms. Do you have a favorite example of a deeper learning unit?
Absolutely. So, and you know, I don't even know if the teacher saw it this way, but she knew what she was doing. I was in a class, first grade classroom in Baltimore, and the teacher brings in a hermit crab. And the kids are all very interested, and she's asked them, you know, tell me your questions. What questions do you have about the crab? And, well, the kids have lots of questions. They want to know, where are the eyes? They want to know, what does it eat? Is it a boy or a girl? How can you tell? They have lots of questions. And after asking questions, then she says, I want you to sit down. I want you to draw a picture of the crab, and I want you to write a story about the crab. And for 2 hours, the kids are there totally engaged. They're coming up looking at the crab. They're talking to each other about the crab, and they're hard at work. And I asked the teacher later, I said, why did you bring in the crab? She says, it's like magic. It's not the same as just showing a picture. And I would say that that's just one of many examples. I'm visiting a high school in the Bronx, one of the coldest days of the year, and the kids are bundling up to go outside. I said, where are you guys going? It's freezing out. They said, we're going to collect samples from the Bronx River. I said, why are you collecting samples from the Bronx River? It's polluted. I said, that's where we're going. We're tracking the pollutants in the river. We're looking at the plant and animal life that survived in the river. And they're doing that in their chemistry class. And I asked the chemistry teacher, why are you studying the Bronx River in chemistry? He said, because I want my kids to see themselves as scientists. I want many of them to pursue careers in science. And I know if they're doing science, as opposed to simply learning it from a textbook, they're more likely to see its relevance.
Okay,
so these are just a couple examples, and I could give many more.
But I just want to dissect these examples a little bit. Because it's fascinating. Because in that first grade classroom, it sounds like what that teacher was doing in Baltimore, first of all, was she putting her first graders more in charge of their learning by asking all those questions?
What she was doing was inviting them in as learners. She was asking them, what do you see? What do you wonder about when you look at this crab? And kids, you know what's interesting? The most popular subject of children till about middle school is science. Because science is how we explain the world and how we explain the natural environment and our own bodies. And if you nurture that curiosity about the world, kids do become independently motivated. And that's what I was seeing in that first grade classroom. These were inner city kids in Baltimore. And that's why this is an equity issue, because too often it's affluent kids that have those learning experiences, not poor children.
So, Professor Noguera, this is such an important point, and I want to hear more of what you have to say about this, because as you know, there are many parents in certain socioeconomic communities, in diverse communities, who look at their schools and say, you know what? Yeah, of course I want my kid to learn science. I want my child to love it, but they need foundational skills first. And they're not getting that enough in school. So we got to focus on reading. We have to focus on math. Let the other stuff wait, because otherwise my children will never be able to catch up to those kids in the richer school districts.
Well, you have to do both. You have to make sure that kids are acquiring the basic skills as well when they are learning. So for example, we know the best way to get kids to write well is to get them writing. Then you can work on the punctuation and the grammar and sentence structure. But if you can't get kids to put pen to paper because they have no motivation, you're not going to get them to become good writers. And that's true in almost any subject. You've got to get them engaged first. And once you hook them in, think about kids who become avid readers. They don't become avid readers because they were good at phonics. They become avid readers because they have the basic skills, and then they found things they really like to read. And once that happens, they take off, and they become independently motivated readers. And that's one of the best ways to raise achievement.
Now, are you saying that we have come through an era where the presumption is that children in certain types of schools just aren't ready for that kind of learning?
I think that what happened is that with no child behind, we had bureaucrats who were focused on standardized test scores, taking control of our schools, and completely ignored everything we'd known for generations about learning. We didn't focus on how do we create conditions in schools that allow teachers to do their best work, that get kids motivated and engaged. That's what we should be focused on right now. Because once you create those conditions, kids will be more likely to learn and to achieve. And that's what we should focus on all throughout the country. We should see kids busy at work, hard at work, committed to doing their best work, and teachers who are showing them how to do that. For example, we don't do our best work on the first draft. The real learning comes from revising that work and learning through your mistakes. Well, we have to have teachers who are willing to create a safe environment where kids will ask questions, where kids are not afraid of making mistakes, where the learning is what we're after, not the grade. And that's what I think has gotten lost.
Okay. We've got about 30 seconds before we have to take a break, Professor Nogueira, but I just want to quickly ask you, in the places where this kind of deeper learning is happening, are we seeing evidence that those gaps are closing?
Absolutely. And we've seen it for a long time. Montessori schools, Waldorf schools. Unfortunately, those schools mostly serve elite kids. But I like to remind people, Maria Montessori started her schools for the poorest kids in Italy. But when it came to the United States, became almost exclusively available to the affluent. There are a few Montessori schools that serve poor children, and they do exactly what I've described.
Well, we are talking this hour about the second part in our month-long series about the 50-year fight, solutions to closing the achievement gap. We're joined today by Pedro Nogueira, he's founder of the Center for the Transformation of Schools at the University of California, Los Angeles. We'll be back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about part two of our month-long series about the 50-year fight, solutions to closing the achievement gap. And we are taking a look at things that work, whether on a societal scale or just down to the scale of an individual classroom, when it comes to efforts to close those achievement or opportunity gaps, as they're also called. And I'm joined today by Pedro Nogueira. He is founder of the Center for the Transformation of Schools at the University of California, Los Angeles. He joins us today from the studios of NPR West in Culver City, California. And we're talking about this idea this hour about deep learning or experiential learning or project-based learning and how this approach to education can help close gaps. And I just want to tell folks that late last week, On Point producer Grace Tatter and I actually visited a school in Massachusetts, the Springfield Renaissance School. They teach 6th grade through 12th grade there, so middle school through high school. And we took a look at what they did. They do a lot of experiential learning. They focus a lot on social and emotional development. And we talked to several teachers there. One of them was Molly Dill. She is a government teacher for high school seniors at Springfield Renaissance School. And on the day we talked to her, she had mentioned they were going through a unit about government and civics and how you create or organize a government. Her students had been reading John Locke, Thomas Hobbes. One of their next assignments was going to be to write a constitution for a fictional country that they were going to create. And teacher Molly Dill talked to us about how she keeps the learning process active in the classroom.
The idea is I'm not spending a lot of time up here talking and teaching to the students. Like, it is really like I'm throwing ideas out there to them and asking them to work with them. I'm giving them projects that get at the standards that I want them to hit. But they're doing the work to, we like to say they're uncovering the knowledge rather than the teacher covering it.
That's Molly Dill, teacher at Springfield, Massachusetts Renaissance School there. It is a public middle school and high school in Springfield, Massachusetts. Their graduation rate is north of 97%. On statewide standardized tests, they score higher than other schools in Springfield, Massachusetts, but they don't score as high as some of the high-performing districts in other parts of the state. So interesting there. Pedro Noguera, just reflect on what that teacher Molly Dill was telling us, that her whole approach to teaching is quite rather different.
Right. She's basically describing herself as the facilitator of learning rather than as the depositor of information to students. She's not doing the direct instruction because that's not the way kids learn. If you watch a child and they're playing a new video game, they don't download a lecture first. They get on there and play. They learn by doing. They learn by modeling. They learn by mistakes, making mistakes. And they learn ultimately through mastery, by getting better and better. Those are the kinds of learning experiences our kids should be having in school. And she gave an example of kids learning civics, reading Hobbes, reading Locke. So they're reading rigorous text. At the same time, they're applying them in ways to think about how would we organize a government that was fair, that was just. These are really important examples. In many schools, social studies is the least favorite subject. That's why so many Americans know so little about their own history, because we don't teach it very well. We don't understand our Constitution. And I would say in a classroom like we just heard about, those kids are going to come away much more prepared to be participants in a democracy because they've experienced that in their classroom.
All right. So Professor Noguera, though, I have to tell you something else that Molly Dill told us. She was talking about how the teaching and learning that goes on at Renaissance School in Springfield is completely different from her own experience, that she went to a school that was extremely test-focused, right? They were doing test prep all the time, but she went to a great college. She got a great education thereafter. And one of the concerns that we heard coming out of Springfield was, you know, they love the way students are teaching and learning there, but doesn't necessarily match what they're going to get in college. Like, that was very interesting to me. So there's still this concern about, is there a gap between even these superior methods of teaching and learning and what students will face after they graduate from 12th grade? What do you think about that?
Well, you know, a lot will depend on the type of college they go to and the experiences they'll have there. And unfortunately, we haven't seen as much change at the university level in the way we teach students. We still rely primarily on lecture. I'd say sciences are an exception here, but in most of the humanities and social sciences, it's primarily lecture. And a lot of the learning students do on their own. So I don't think universities are the great model. We assume that because you have a PhD, you know how to teach. And I think there are many of us who know that that's not necessarily the case. So I think K-12 education is actually driving improvements in teaching and learning if they have the freedom to do the kinds of work that we just heard about in Springfield. The problem is that in many schools, there's a fear that if you try to get to do this kinds of approach to teaching and learning, test scores won't rise. And so there's a fear amongst the administrators and sometimes amongst the teachers that we've got to do drills, we've got to do test preparation, that this is what's going to lead to higher scores. And the evidence shows it hasn't worked. It's actually bored kids. It's made them more alienated, less engaged. And I think we need to shift the focus entirely onto how to get kids motivated and engaged, doing the kind of work that we know will result in more the kinds of skills that they're going to need in life, how to write well, how to reason, how to problem solve, so that they are going to be adaptable to the changes that are occurring in our society.
So I want to get to a couple callers here in just a second, but Professor Noguera, and forgive me if this is a repetition of what I asked you before, but I think this is a really core question. And because you talked about that fear being the thing that may be stopping teachers and districts from adopting different models of teaching, and learning. But for as long as, even in the post-No Child Left Behind era that we're in, for as long as standardized tests, statewide standardized tests, hold a lot of sway. I mean, they're the measure by which a state is saying, here's what we think it's important is important to learn. How are these deeper learning models going to really make any headway, especially in the communities that may benefit most from them?
Again, it's a question of how we use the test. If we use the test as a tool to diagnose the learning needs, to give teachers feedback on what they should focus on with the kids, to give students feedback on what they need to focus on, then that's an effective use of assessment. We've been using testing to primarily rank kids, rank teachers, rank schools. Ranking does not help you. We can tell a teacher or a school that you're not performing well. What we don't know how to do is help them to improve. And so across the country, we have all these schools that are labeled as failing, and it is, to me, an indictment on the whole educational system that we send kids to schools that we know can't meet their needs. Mm. The whole strategy is bankrupt, and we need to shift the focus on how to create the environment, the conditions that allow good teaching and learning to occur.
Well, Professor O'Gara, stand by for just a second because our phones are ringing off the hook here.
That's people, a good sign.
People care about education. Let's go to Betsy, who's calling from Baltimore, Maryland. Betsy, you're on the air.
Hello. Thank you so much for taking my call. I think your guest really has his finger on the pulse of this thing. And I wanted to tell you about a school that my son attended. He's a senior in high school, but this was his elementary middle school. I have a recovering from a cold, but his school was theme-based, and they did three themes per year, per school year. And at the end of each theme, there was this thing called a theme event in which the entire school participated in and put on. It was like a three-hour event, and all the parents were invited. So it was like a huge, big deal.
Yeah.
A lot of fun. And, I mean, these kids learned. I mean, my son learned how to write a paper, do drafts. They got to dress up and play characters, and like one whole theme would be the Civil War. Another theme would be a place, Africa, Spain. Mm-hmm. They just pick a country, and then the other theme, the third theme would be like a concept.
Yeah.
I can't remember, but it was just like these kids were amazing, and every class, math, art, music, social studies,
all around that theme.
Participated in the theme.
I hear you, Betsy. Thank you so much for your call. I'm going to take it back from you there. So Betsy from Baltimore, talking about theme-based learning being a real success for her kids there. Let's turn now to Matthew Riggin, who is joining us from Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. He's co-founder and executive director at the Workshop School. It's a public high school where students spend most of their days working on interdisciplinary hands-on projects. And their student body is 100% eligible for free and reduced lunch. 99% of the students who go to the Workshop School are students of color. Matthew Riggin, welcome to you.
Good to be with you, Meghna. Thanks.
So first of all, tell us a little bit more about the Workshop School's approach. How do students learn there?
So I think there are kind of two really important things to understand about our approach. One is that when we think about the skills that students really need to be successful long-term, and we are a high school, so we're thinking about what productive, fulfilled adulthood looks like. Most of the skills that we know are most critical to their success are things like solving ill-structured problems, collaboration, emotional intelligence, project management, sort of long-range planning and goal setting. And yet, if you look at what high school tends to expect of students, it focuses largely on kind of a static body of content knowledge. And so one thing that we're really trying to do is say, what type of learning experiences will help our students cultivate this broader set of skills that are most essential to their long-range success? And then the second thing is, as you noted out when you talked about our demographics, is what does it look like to do this work with students who have faced a tremendous amount of discrimination, who have faced a tremendous amount of social and economic disadvantage, and who have often been through schools that are very, very focused on sort of test preparation with a very narrow and very remedial curriculum.
Okay. And so, I mean, give us an example of some of the, like, one of the projects that the workshop school has done.
Sure. So the general arc of our school is that in your first 2 years in 9th and 10th grade, you're immersed in a whole range of different projects that are cross-disciplinary. So we are primarily not organized by subject area. Our students have about 3.5 hours in the morning where they're in a single group of students, which we refer to as an advisory. They typically work on two different projects at a time. And those projects can cover a broad range of topics. So, for example, right now we have 10th graders who are doing digital memoirs where they chronicle a key moment in their own learning and then shoot a sort of short documentary that focuses on that. We have 11th and 12th graders who are designing escape rooms because escape rooms, if you've ever been through one, require an enormous amount of collaboration, an enormous amount of problem solving, and designing one is even harder than going through one. And so they design these things over the course of a trimester, and then we end that project with a public night where people come in and actually pay money to get locked in classrooms by high school students.
Could you get out of their escape room, Mr. Regan?
The prototypes are impossible because it turns out our kids really like making it hard. Eventually, we have them meet with professional escape room designers, and one of the things that they tell them is, look, this is ultimately supposed to be fun. You want people to get out. So one of the things they have to do is when they design them, people will go through and do test runs on them, and they can kind of figure out where there are gaps, where more information is needed, where there's a little design flaw in the room or the scenario. And so they learn to curb their more mean instincts, but it's fun putting them in charge.
Now, Matthew Regan, I know I've got to let you go in here in a couple of minutes, but like, let's cut to the chase here, because our big question is, do these other methods of teaching and learning close gaps? So there is a statewide test in Pennsylvania. Your students take the test. How do they do?
To be really candid, our students don't do especially well on state tests. There's a couple of things that I would say about that. One is that we have criterion reference exams, which means they set to a specific threshold, which is intended to indicate college readiness. On average, our students come into us, if we use the data that we test at baseline, our kids come in around a fifth grade level in reading and math. And so when they take those tests in ninth or 10th grade, they don't tend to pass them. But the flip side is that we have about 30% of our upperclassmen, that is to say our 11th and 12th graders, who are currently enrolled in credit-bearing college classes, and our pass rates for those are very, very high, including for students who have not passed the state exams. Similarly, we have about two-thirds of our graduating class from last year enrolled in college classes now and are doing quite well. So we have super high college acceptance rates. We seem to have pretty good persistence rates. We're a new school, so that's still an evolving picture. And yet, we have lower test scores. And so the question is, which of those metrics is really most meaningful? Which one should we really be concentrating on? We argue for the set of outcomes we should be focusing on are actual life outcomes, not metrics that are not necessarily predictive of long-term success.
Because the workshop school has been in existence for 7 years now?
Yeah, this is year seven.
Year seven. Okay, so your oldest students who've gone through it would only have been out in the world for a couple of years.
That's correct, yeah.
I see. Okay, so tell me about this question about what are the best measures of success here? How has Philadelphia responded? How has the state responded? I mean, when you say that on statewide tests in Pennsylvania, your students don't actually score as great, but on these other metrics they do fairly well, what's the response to that?
Well, I think we're a little bit out at the vanguard in terms of doing this work, and so there isn't necessarily right now an institutional framework to think about schools like ours. But I think there's an understanding that the traditional model of high school, where you're trying to just sort of pile up content knowledge and progress in a very traditional way, doesn't seem to work for a lot of students, and especially doesn't work all that well for students who are coming from kind of more disadvantaged backgrounds. So what Philadelphia has done has created this small body of schools called the Innovation Network that are specifically tasked with trying to find newer and different models for thinking about particularly how we approach high school education. For us, the conversation is all about what are the sort of long-term metrics that we're really interested in, and then what is it we need to be doing during high school to move students toward those. So obviously, are students getting accepted into college? Are they graduating first and foremost, mm-hmm. and our graduation rates are really high. Are they graduating? Are they matriculating into college or into a career that has actual sort of viability, progression, stability? And then can we look at those indicators over time? So just getting a student into college doesn't necessarily mean that they're going to be successful. I think one of the things that we've learned is that there are a lot of kids who sort of make it to college but don't necessarily make it through the first year, and there's a whole set of skills that you need to survive that transition that we need to all get better at teaching and supporting. So the conversation with us is really about how do we develop a kind of index of long-term post-secondary success that includes how students are doing at work, how they're doing at college, and then how in control or in command they feel of their future and of their circumstances.
Well, Matthew Riggin, co-founder and executive director at the Workshop School in Philadelphia, a school that's a public high school that spends most of their days, a student spends most of their days working on interdisciplinary and hands-on projects. Matthew Riggin, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And we're also joined today by Pedro Noguera. He's founder of the Center for the Transformation of Schools at the University of California, Los Angeles. Professor Noguera, we'll hear more from you when we come back from a quick break. This is part two of our special month-long series on the 50-year fight, solutions for closing the achievement gap, where we're taking a look at what actually works, whether it's across a district, across the nation, or even in individual classrooms. And today we're looking at deep learning. Experiential learning is a powerful way to help students excel. This is On Point.
Every day in America, 60 million packages are delivered. But we don't always know what's inside.
He bent down to pick the package up. That's when the device detonated.
Danger is everywhere. No one is safe in Austin, Texas, as law enforcement hunts a serial bomber for 19 days. From Sony Music Entertainment, Campside Media, and Pegalo Pictures, this is Witnessed. 19 Days. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts to binge all episodes or listen weekly wherever you get your podcasts.
Smart journalism. Fascinating topics. Words that describe CNN's podcast, The Assignment with Audie Cornish.
Last year, the Army missed its recruitment goal. It had 65,000 spots to fill and came up 10,000 short of that target. Why is it so hard to recruit? How's the Pentagon responding? And how are the voices of service members on social media shifting the balance?
Listen to The Assignment with Audie Cornish wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about solutions to closing the achievement gap. This is our series we're calling The 50-Year Fight. This hour in the series, we're taking a look at different learning and teaching models, specifically along the lines of deep learning and experiential learning, and why those may be powerful tools to help close gaps in American schools. And I'm joined today by Pedro Noguera. He's founder of the Center for the Transformation of Schools at the University of California, Los Angeles. He's with us from the studios of NPR West in Culver City, California. And Professor Noguera, before the break, we heard Matthew Riggin from Philadelphia there talking about what they do at the workshop high school. And I wanted to hear your thoughts on what he said near the end of our chat with him about how on those statewide tests in Pennsylvania, his students don't do so well compared to maybe some children at other schools, but that they're also looking at different measures of what an educational success means. What are your thoughts about that?
Well, I have two thoughts, Meghna. One is that I think it is important to look at a variety of ways in which to evaluate what we're doing. And they were looking at college enrollment and persistence. Mm-hmm. How well do our kids do in college? Do they stay in college? I would also say that you can do performance-based assessment where you actually look at the work kids produce and assess how strong that work is. Where are they making progress? Where are the errors? What do they tell us both about the students' needs and about what the teachers should focus on? But in addition, I would say that they should not ignore the state assessments. They should really ask, have we embedded all those standards our kids will need to know to do well on those state assessments? So although they're getting good results in terms of graduation rates, they should not settle for that. They should continue to look back and ask those tough questions. What I really liked about what Matthew said is they start by asking, what do our kids need to know? And how do we make sure that we create learning experiences that teach them those very important skills? they have to continue that and not settle for the fact that they are a good school by Philadelphia standards. They want to be a great school for those kids. And that's why this work we do in education doesn't allow us to just kind of rest on our laurels. We have to continue to reflect on what we're doing and ask, are we meeting the needs of our kids? Are we really preparing them? I would also say one more thing. Most of what kids learn in school, they forget.
Mm-hmm.
They only retain the things they continue to apply. The most important thing for kids to learn is how to learn, how to continue to learn long after the test is over, long after you graduate from high school or college, because we live in a world where things are changing constantly. And if you're not good at learning, you're going to find yourself obsolete.
Mm. Well, let's go to John, who's calling from Burlington, Vermont. John, you're on the air.
Hi. I love the show, and I'd like to make 2 points. First, I'd like to just say that I agree with your guest. The school my kids did go to, public school, very good school, started that system of learning a few years back, actually probably 5 years now. But they left out some of the basics that you were talking about, the reading and writing. The writing and grammar were basically not taught. And my kids, who were very, I consider, high achieving or on the higher end, their scores tended to fall, while other kids who were on the lower end came up. And what was happening is they were teaching to the minimum standard. And bringing those kids up, which I think is great, but the kids who were already on the higher end were falling down because they were just not achieving.
I see.
Forcing us to take our kids out of public school and put them in private school where they're excelling.
Well, John, I'm going to take it back from you there, and thank you so much for your call. Professor Noguera, respond to John. I mean, it looks like he's saying that without foundational skills, deeper learning doesn't work.
Absolutely. You need both. You can't just have kids doing exploration and not give them the basics. They do need to learn to write well. They need to understand grammar. They need to know how to study for an exam. So there are some essential skills that kids need, but that should not come at the expense of inquiry and using strategies like we heard Matthew using to get kids engaged. You can do both. And there are schools that are doing both. And it's so we have evidence that it can work. But we should point out that it's not easy, and it takes time to get it right, and it takes educators who are collaborating and thinking together. How do we make sure that our kids are getting what they need, that the standards that the state has set are embedded in what we're doing so that our kids will, in fact, be prepared?
Mm. Well, I want to go now to Atlanta, Georgia. Keen Walker joins us from Atlanta. Keen's a social studies teacher at South Atlanta High School who regularly incorporates experience-based learning into his teaching. For example, this week, his students are presenting case studies to Fortune 500 companies based in Atlanta. South Atlanta High School is a traditional public high school, has about 800 students, 93% of whom are Black, 6% Hispanic, 6% Hispanic, I should say, and 1% white. Keen Walker, welcome to On Point.
Thanks for having me, you guys.
So tell us a little bit more about the kind of teaching you do in your classroom there.
Well, basically, I'm sitting here looking at an article right now, and this article is about education in Finland. And when I looked at the article, I was sitting there basically just blown away saying, this is it. This is what I've been doing my entire teaching career because people have allowed me to do it. So the type of learning that we're doing right now, we're actually working on what I call a visual essay. And we started with the continent of Africa because I'm very, very, very clear with my students that we must be very intentional about making sure that we have cultural relevance. And if we went by the pacing guide that we use, we almost never make it to the back of the book where we discuss Africa. So the students are actually being given a case challenge in my class that's going to prepare them for the case challenge that they will be doing on tomorrow with AIG, which is a Fortune 500 company. And a lot of the students in the class, before I left out this morning to come to the radio interview, a lot of the students were like, Mr. Walker, this has really changed our paradigm about the way we see education, because you oftentimes say in class, content versus context. So I think what we're doing now is we're challenging them by making them look through a totally different set of lens. And I heard somebody mention knowledge-based information, and I'll just say this, and I'll let you throw back any other question. You might have heard of a KWL. A lot of schools do what we know, what we want to know, what we learn. Mm-hmm. But in our class, we do KLAs, what you know, what you learn, and how you can apply it. Because if you can't apply it to the real world, then we're not preparing you for the 21st century. We're preparing you for the 20th century.
Wow. And how different is this from what goes on in your classroom, say, from the experiences your very students had, in 6th, 7th, 8th, 9th grade?
Oh, one kid, he's an entrepreneur. He came to class and he told me, and I don't say where he came from, but he told me, he said, "Ms. Walker, up until this point, I can't say that I've ever retained anything I've learned in school. And after being in your class for 1 week, I feel like I've learned more in 1 week than I've learned through my entire school career up to this point." So I think what happens is when the students come to my class, I'm reminded of something that I learned from a book, James Lowen, Teaching What Really Matters. And in that book, James Lawrence talks about teaching the branches, not the whole tree. And when students come into the classroom, I just basically make it pragmatic. I make it so that if you come into this classroom and you have a skill set, we're going to fine-tune that skill set, and we're not going to waste all of our energies looking at all of the things that the system has deemed negative. And I want to ask this question right here so you'll get a glimpse into my classroom. When I've listened this morning, I've heard a lot of great feedback from both the callers and from the people who are on the show this morning or this afternoon or this evening, whenever you actually hear the broadcast. I want to ask the question, which gap are we trying to close? Are we trying to close the testing gap? Or are we trying to close the gap that's going to help to prepare our kids to compete against students all around the world?
Mr. Walker, thank you so much for asking that, because I think this is exactly one of the questions we ought to be interrogating over and over and over again. Hear a bit of a beep there. But let me ask you, as a teacher, and I'm so grateful that you're here because you're in a classroom doing this day in and day out. I mean, do you feel pressures to close gaps? And if so, which gaps are we talking about?
So that is so ironic. I fortunately am able to be in a new program at my school called 3DE, where we're actually doing case challenges and whatnot, and I'm not in one of the traditional testing classes this year. So if I could speak on behalf of my colleagues, I would say a lot of them are under so much pressure to get certain test scores that I've heard students as well as teachers just say, like, "Hey, I want to either leave the public school system because my friends who are in private school, they don't have this type of anxiety about testing," or teacher slash colleagues who are saying, "I can't continue to do this because I have students who are coming to me 4 or 5 grade levels behind as far as their reading skills are concerned, but you're still expecting me to compete against schools where the kids are coming in 4 or 5 grade levels above." So you have kids who are coming in 4 or 5 grade levels above what the Lexile scores are. Mm-hmm. So even if the teacher did not teach anything in that classroom for a semester, those kids are going to pass those standardized tests. But the students we're working with, I think oftentimes, and I'm speaking on behalf of my colleagues, they're sitting there thinking, "Hey, I haven't even taken something such as the reading endorsement, so I don't even know how to teach. So how do I take a baby who's sitting in my room and I can just clearly see that the light is not going on right now?" Mm-hmm. Because this kid right here, he's sitting here trying to juxtapose what a word means with how to spell a word. So that pressure is real, and I think people need to come out and volunteer to be in the classroom so they can see what we're up against and then think about competing against, I guess, if you're taking an NFL player and you had that NFL player competing against a kid who plays rec league football, but you're expecting that rec league football player to actually go out on Sundays and compete against an NFL player, I think that is like the best way for me to paint a picture of right. What a lot of my colleagues are up against.
Well, Mr. Walker, hang on here for a second. Pedro Noguera, let me turn back to you. What do you hear in what King Walker's talking about in terms of his experience in his own classroom and his fellow teachers and the pressures they feel?
So it sounds like Keene has got the issues right, you know, that he's trying to prepare kids who come in underprepared, who don't have the foundation. But the first step is to get them engaged. If you can't get them engaged, you're not going to move them at all. Now the next question is, can you provide them with the skills they're going to need to do more advanced work? Math particularly is a subject where if you don't have the foundation, it's going to be very hard to do more complex advanced math. There are teachers now who get that, who are doing both. They're not dumbing down the curriculum. but they are making sure they're diagnosing learning needs. They're making sure that the holes in their education get filled so that kids can do algebra and calculus, eventually geometry, so they can do the more advanced learning that gets them prepared for college. So again, we keep, you know, we've been caught in this debate about whether or not we do basics in a traditional approach or whether or not we can get kids engaged through project-based learning and other strategies. And in fact, you've got to do both. And you've got to, again, ask the question, what do our kids need to know and how do we teach it? Right. If when teachers are asking that question and doing it together, then they can plan lessons together that allow kids to learn the skills and do it in a way that gets them engaged. And he's given examples, and we heard Matthew give some examples from Philadelphia as well.
Mr. Walker, I got to let you go here in a second, but I've got one more question for you. What do you think you and your fellow teachers there, how about right there at South Atlanta High School, what do you need to help scale what you're doing in your classroom across the high school? How could you accomplish that?
Well, I think one thing, and I'll just give you six little, I'll give you a quick rundown of some things that I'm doing right now as we speak in my classroom. And I think people all around the nation could use this. And I call these the seven secrets to inspiring and empowering black boys, but it can be used with any subgroup. And the first thing is, I just said to my students when I walked out, if you tell me your habits, I can tell you your future. So if we're talking about basic skill as well as experiential learning, you're not going to get what you need to get just by coming to the building every day. So I oftentimes tell them that there's a difference in schooling and education. So your habits, your expectations, your connectivity, asking questions. I conclude because I know we don't have a lot of time. Here's the thing I want everybody to think about as we get ready to leave here today. I say to my students every single day, I'm not concerned about your answers. I'm only concerned about your questions. Because if you're asking the right questions, the first question is, Mr. Walker, can I stay up to school and you can work with me on reading? Mr. Walker, if I want to be a lawyer, what are some things I need to do in preparation for that? So I wish we could continue this conversation at a later date because I would love to actually go through didactically and show you or speak to your audience about what it is that I do. But I'm kind of just trying to squeeze it all in, you know, like in 1 minute.
Well, you know, Mr. Walker, though, you got a lot in that minute. We really appreciate you giving us a quick glimpse into how you're teaching the kids at South Atlanta High School. We'll come back to you sometime in the future, I promise. So Keene Walker, joining us from Atlanta, Georgia, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you very much.
All right, Pedro Nogueira, I want to circle back to finish this conversation on two quick questions. First of all, one is, I'm keenly interested in how we scale these good ideas up. I mean, I think anyone listening to this hour would say, yeah, I know a teacher who's doing something like that, or even a school. But it's not necessarily something that's caught fire across the country. How do we scale it up?
Well, that's important. And then I heard Matthew talk about Philadelphia creating an innovation zone within the district that gives teachers or schools a chance to experiment, but hopefully to learn. Now, the key question is, are they getting feedback so they can continue to improve over time? That would be the question I would pose to Philadelphia. Atlanta, and one of the things we heard Keene say is the fear that teachers are operating under, the fear of not having the test scores and it driving many teachers out of the profession. That fear, think about what it did. A few years ago, it led to a cheating scandal where several teachers were changing test scores and many of them ended up going to prison. And we should know that's not just an Atlanta issue. We've got cheating going on in many parts of the country. We've also got kids stressed out because they're of testing. We've got a big problem across the country with depression and suicide amongst children. So we have a lot of evidence that what we've been doing isn't working. The joy of learning is what we should be after. And we get at that by getting kids intrinsically motivated, by tapping into that natural curiosity and fueling that curiosity throughout their education. And there are schools that are doing that in private schools, charter schools, public schools. It's happening. What we've not done is to learn from those schools. We should elevate those schools and give educators from other places a chance. And state governments have to allow that kind of innovation to occur.
And just to reflect on something you said earlier in the hour, also just acknowledge that kids who were presumed to not be ready for this kind of teaching and learning are hungry for it, and that's the equity issue. Well, Pedro Nogueira, founder of the Center for the Transformation of Schools at the University of California, Los Angeles, joining us from the studios of NPR West in Culver City, California. Professor Nogueira, thank you so very much.
Thank you, Meghna.
And folks, we are doing this series on solutions to closing the achievement gap all month, and we want to keep hearing your stories. What are you seeing in your schools, in your districts? We've got a survey about this. It's at onpointradio.org. Head over to our website, check it out, and take the survey. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.